Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Theater Podcast, intimate personal conversations with theater's biggest names. This episode is with director and writer Alex Timbers, who currently has two shows on Broadway, Moulin Rouge and, of course, Beetlejuice. And being September, this continues the Beetlejuice takeover here on the Theater Podcast. So we are very excited to bring you this two-part episode with Alex Timbers. I was really fascinated when I learned that Moulin Rouge and Beetlejuice opened within months of each other. I always think it's so cool when multiple shows open it's simultaneously that have multiple creatives that work on the same thing. Like William Ivy Long opened Beetlejuice and Tootsie within a day of each other. And he did costumes for both of those. And of course, Alex here directed both Moulin Rouge and Beetlejuice. And, you know, Beetlejuice he's been working on for almost 10 years. And Moulin Rouge, not as long, but still, like, you just never know when it's going to hit. So sometimes it just happens. You have multiple things. So he balances his life very well. We talked about that a little bit. Something he said, too, that really, really impressed me and resonated with me as someone who has started their own podcast because, you know, I'm trying to make more opportunities for myself. He said that as a young director, there was kind of like this stigma that until you had gray hair, until you were like in your 40s or 50s, that you weren't allowed to direct anything big. And so he just went off and created his own stuff. He wrote Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, which was his directorial Broadway debut. And basically his whole life, he was creating things from scratch. And he created his own cable access show here in New York City at age 12. So just an incredible guy. This was a great conversation. Of course, this is part one. Part two will come out in a few days. So please stay tuned and visit thetheaterpodcast.com/Patreon to show your support. If you are at the $5 tier or higher, you get advance notice of these interviews so you can actually submit your questions as well. So everybody, please enjoy this episode with director and writer extraordinaire Alex Timbers.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Here you go, one, 2, 3.
My guest today is a two-time Tony-nominated writer and director and the recipient of Golden Globe, Drama Desk, Outer Critics Circle, and London Evening Standard Awards, as well as two Obie and Lucille Lortel Awards. His Broadway directing credits alone include Moulin Rouge the Musical, Oh Hello on Broadway, Rocky, Peter and the Starcatcher, and of course, Beetlejuice, which was recently nominated for 8 Tony Awards this past 2019 season. He is even a co-writer of the Amazon series Mozart in the Jungle, which won the 2016 Golden Globe Award for Best Television Series. Alex Timbers, welcome to the Theater Podcast.
Hey, how are you?
Did I cover everything?
Oh my gosh, that was so thorough. I learned some stuff.
People are like, yeah, I need you to write my bio all the time. I in researching you, I knew you from the theater scene, but I didn't know you from the television side until I was researching for this episode. And I'm really impressed with, we're basically the same age. You're 2 years older than me, and which makes me feel like I didn't accomplish anything in my life. But let's start out, I guess, at the beginning. Where did you grow up and what kind of kid were you?
I grew up in New York City, went to school here, saw a little theater, acted always in my school play. I went to an all-boys school, so sometimes that was playing guys, sometimes I was playing Madame Jardin and Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme. And went to school here. And then the big thing I did as a kid was founded a public access TV show in New York.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, when I was 12. And it was like a sketch comedy show. And me and two fellow students, and we were on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, Channel 69, on right after Dyke TV. It was fantastic. all our friends watched, and the parents too. Yeah.
Wow. So you were involved with comedy young.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. I feel like that was more the starting ground for my interest in theater than in theater itself, actually.
Do you watch your old videos of when you were 12 or 13, 14, and you're just like, how did I make it through this point in my life?
No, I would be mortified, but my parents do remind me of them frequently.
Do they have copies?
I think their copies probably do exist.
Oh, you got to take them off of the Betamax, whatever they are, VHS.
In my will, it will say they will be burned.
So that was, okay. So you got the cable access. That was your, I guess, foray into performing. Did your parents encourage this, or were they like, it's a side project, he'll just, you know?
They've been encouraging through my life, but I don't think it was sort of, I think they would be the first to say it wasn't sort of their world. And so when I went to high school, I went to school in Illinois, and the school was amazing because it had a whole sort of video component to it, a telecom. Mm-hmm. So they had a three-camera studio, some of the first nonlinear editors, that you could get for, educational use. And so it had another little TV show there and started selling shorts and things like that. And I sold one to PBS when I was 15. It was kind of cool.
Wow.
Yeah, it was great. And then going to college, I did improv and sketch and got really interested in the mechanics of comedy. And got interested in the idea of directing a farce and thinking that was that would be an interesting way to explore comedy further, and directed another farce, and then was like, I really like directing theater. And that so it was really comedy that was the entree into theater.
Wow. And when was the first time that you directed an actual theater production?
It was probably when I was 19. I directed a black comedy by Peter Schaffer, and then I directed Lend Me a Tenor, which was on Broadway a couple of years ago, actually. Yeah, and a great revival.
That's crazy. Okay, so you were in New York, and that's when you realized you wanted to direct, I guess, around, in late teens. Did you ever perform, or did you always know you wanted to be, kind of behind the scenes?
I did perform a little bit. I remember my freshman year acting in a production of The Marriage of Bette and Boo. So this is freshman year of college, and I played Boo. And I remember just the whole time, just being sort of outside of my own performance. I'm sure people have had this experience all the time as actors, and just watching it and adjudicating it and just thinking, wasn't in the moment, wasn't very good. I knew that too. And I just thought, maybe I should be the person on, someone on the other side of the footlights.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I've been there and watched myself. And I'm like, maybe I should do this. Yeah. I think it's a sign that you need to be behind the scenes. And then you mentioned college and you went to Yale.
Yeah.
Graduated magna cum laude.
Thank you.
You're a smarty. What did you your major in there?
Film and TV as a double major. My focus in film was Polish Eastern European cinema, particularly Polish cinema. Very specific.
Why that?
I just love, it felt to me like Ibsen. It felt like this sort of, world that was exotic to me, but had these kind of really sort of present contemporary moral questions that felt like that was the work that people like Vida was grappling with, and Kieślowski. And I just felt very emotionally resonant to me.
So now I mentioned earlier, you're 41 and mm-hmm. and now running on Broadway simultaneously, you've got Moulin Rouge and Beetlejuice
yeah.
that you directed. How do you approach these projects? I guess the first question, did they both come to you at the same time, or do you work on them in parallel? Obviously, to put them up, you do. But do you know they're going to be released or open at the same time?
No, it's a total coincidence. I started work on Beetlejuice 10 years ago, started work on Moulin Rouge 6 years ago. And it's just, you know, fate that they're happening at the exact same time.
Is that something you try to avoid, or you're just like, it is what it is?
I mean, you feel lucky when anything gets to production. That's how I generally feel. But I will say this last 15 months have been fairly punishing.
Yeah, your gray hair is
yeah.
slightly increased. So in 2010, you also had Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson
yeah.
and the Pee-wee Herman Show, both in development at the same time. Are they were in? Or did they open at the same time?
No, oh, yeah, they were basically yeah. in. I think we were in previews of Andrew Jackson while Pee Wee was happening. I had never done a show on Broadway before, and it definitely felt crazy. I felt very lucky, but also very crazy.
Was that? I guess the process of bringing something to the Broadway stage. I mean, obviously, I know the answer is yes, but how much more complicated is it for Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, your first Broadway directorial debut? How different was that versus other projects?
Well, you know, Andrew Jackson was interesting in that I had done it like 3 or 4 times at this point. We had done a production at Williamstown that was very different from the Broadway production. We did a production in LA that was very different from the Broadway production. But then we did it twice at the Public at the Shiva, and then a year later in the Newman, and then moved it to Broadway. So in a mm-hmm. way, it felt like even though we made, you know, adjustments for Broadway and the scale was different, it felt a little bit like you were remounting something. Also, I had been very lucky in that I had gotten to assist on Jersey Boys years before. So there was a slight kind of demystification of the mm-hmm. Broadway teching process that was, I thought, really useful in the end.
That's fun. So then you take that, obviously, and you can scale up now. And Beetlejuice and Moulin Rouge both are no small feats. They are massive productions. And Moulin Rouge, I don't know the production budget, but the licensing fees alone have to be astronomical.
I mean, the trick of licensing all those songs is an incredible feat that the producers pulled off. It's really amazing.
Yeah. So did you have any say into, I'll talk about Moulin Rouge real quick, but did you have mm-hmm. any say into like what songs got included or what didn't?
Oh, yeah.
Or was it all?
Oh, yeah. So I got approached by Baz Luhrmann about 6 years ago. I think it was like summer 2013. And, you know, he's been wonderful because his background, he and Catherine Martin, his creative partner, they, you know, their background is in theater before film. And so they understand the adaptation. I mean, a lot of their films are adaptations. So mm-hmm. so they were wonderful and sort of giving some like key pieces of guidance and then saying, you know, go forth and make something. So as we began the adaptation process, John Logan, the book writer, Justin Levine, the music supervisor, and I got in a hotel room at, I think it was AKA, and I hauled, you know, my girlfriend's synthesizer across Times Square, and we got in there, and we just started plotting out the musical with note cards, just like you do any new story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and as we got to, once we plotted out the plot, we went to the song, where would song spots make sense? And some lined up with songs from the film, some were brand new, and then went through that process of figuring out what song should go where. It was very collaborative, very creative, really fun, really free.
Yeah. So Baz approached you about that?
Yeah, he was very generous. You know, he had seen Andrew Jackson and he had seen Here Lies Love, and I think he felt there was a kind of kindred spirit there. And I think also, you know, he had worked on a lot of stage shows himself and just knew the process was so long and, you know, I think didn't want to, you know, feel like his life was spent remaking past, you know, masterpieces. Right? Yeah, I totally sympathize with that. So right. I was very the lucky recipient of that line of thinking.
Well, so there was that one. And then Beetlejuice, also an adaptation. Well, I guess it's not a remake. It's an adaptation, obviously, from a movie. Did How did that get started? Did Tim Burton approach you, or did you have to approach Tim Burton?
There's a wonderful producer at Warner Brothers who's been there for a long time. It was very important in a lot of Tim Burton's movies as the president of production at Warner's, a guy named Kevin McCormick. And Kevin had seen, this was back in 2010, had seen Andrew Jackson and the Pee Wee Herman show. And we had a meeting about collaborating on something. And he brought up the idea of Beetlejuice. He was like, what about Beetlejuice? And, you know, for me, and I'm sure most directors would say this too, you know, you don't just say, oh, I love the movie Beetlejuice. Yeah, let's make a musical of that.
Right.
I said, huh, well, let me think about it. So I went away for a little bit and I came back and I said, okay, if these three things were true of an adaptation process and we were allowed to explore in these directions, then this could be something very interesting. Mm-hmm. And he was like, oh yeah, I'm on board with all that. Let's do it. And so that was the start of that process.
That's crazy. I wouldn't even know where to begin with that. And something that's got supernatural elements is, I think, so hard to pull off on stage.
Yeah. So I to go into those three things, if it's interesting, you know, one of the things it felt really important is that any stage adaptation was as emotional as possible. And so it felt like Lydia was really the key to that. So we said sort of in the adaptation process, could we focus on Lydia as the protagonist, even though she's kind of a secondary character in the movie? Another thing, you know, in terms of those special effects you're talking about is, can the house, you know, the movie is really interesting and that's pretty much sat in one location for, you know, 90% of the movie. And so, you know, you think of like August Osage County or Virginia Woolf or, you know, name any other play. A lot of them are set in a single location as well. So we said, well, okay, can we make the house a character as well? Mm-hmm. And can it transform? Can it be the Maitland's home and then the Dietz's home and then can Beetlejuice enchant it? So it becomes a sort of magic box. And can all the effects in that way be practical? You see the walls in front of you. It's not like armatures coming out of the ground or anything like that or giant things flying in. It's like the walls are, you know, puppets burst through and, you know, fire spurts out of someone's hand. It's all sort of practical effects and practical, you know, magic before your very eyes. And so, and I think that's key to the Burton aesthetic, especially with that movie. You read these interviews with him and he talks about Beetlejuice, which was his second movie after Pee Wee Herman, believe it or not, but the first one where you really see his aesthetic. And he talks about the kind of DIY charm of that. So it really felt important to, you know, that's why we called up Michael Curry and said, can you make us a giant sandworm and another sandworm and another sandworm and not rely on, you know, video and projections for that kind of thing. The third element that was really important was the idea of leaning into Beetlejuice as a kind of figure that can break the fourth wall. He's a trickster character, so he can pop up next to you, he can lie to you, he can kick over the footlights and, you know, sit in your lap. So that idea of Beetlejuice, who doesn't really appear until 40 minutes into the movie, sort of like Jaws. we wanted him to start it. And we also felt like what was kind of cool about Lydia and Beetlejuice, and if you watch the animated show, I don't know if you grew up with that. I grew up with it.
Oh, yeah.
They're sort of, you know, they're best buddies in that, you know, frenemies, you'd call it now, right? And so the idea of these two kind of con man figures, you know, two very clever people outsmarting each other, outwitting each other, that felt very, musical theory, you look at the line of great con men, you know, Bialystock and Bloom, Harold Hill, it felt like, oh, if these folks could be in that lineage, there's good history there, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the casting is, I mean, it's what we're used to. It seems perfect, though. And you're talking about Lydia, but Sophia, she is now 18. So how old? So you're working on it 10 years ago. Obviously, you didn't find her when she was 8.
No, but I think we started working with her when she was like 15 or something. Like
really?
That. Yeah, yeah. She's incredible. I mean, she's the most amazing actress. And I had seen her in a play at MCC called The Nether, and she was in Lazarus, the David Bowie musical, and then Blackbird. And I was like, this, she's like sort of preternaturally wise, you know? And this amazing singer, which I don't know that a lot of New York knows, or at least a lot of the theater community knows. And so we started developing this with her. She did, I think, everything but the first reading. So she did like two readings, two workshops. She did the Out of Town, and which took place over like 2.5 years. And she's wonderfully committed to it. And I think has brought so much of herself to the role. And I know the writers sort of glommed on to all her ideas. Mm-hmm. And we're just so excited and inspired by her and the collaboration.
There are so many things in life that stress me out. You know what shouldn't stress me out? Eating. So we can all eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So you can choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options for all dietary needs. And you can discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and even some drinks to help you stay fueled up. Factor is also celebrating Earth Day all month long. So look out for the Earth Month's Eats badge on the menu for our lowest carbon footprint meals. Say that 5 times fast. Earth Month Eats. Earth Month Eats. Just remember, these no fuss, no mess meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, and cleaning up. So just simply heat and eat the good stuff. Head to factormeals.com/TTP50 and use code TTP50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code TTP50 at factormeals.com/TTP50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. So what are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up your springtime goals.
The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
What about Alex, Alex Brightman?
Yeah, Alex Brightman. So Alex is fantastic. I mean, he's so smart. He's so funny. So much of the Beetlejuice character is him. I mean, he really starts so early in the collaborative process as well that I feel like the character met him halfway and he met the character halfway. And the writers really wrote into like his improvisation and his ideas. And I think that's why that role fits him so like a glove, because he's had such a hand in developing it. And he's just, you know, his background also, he's done a lot of improv, done a lot of sketch. He's very quick on his feet. He's very, like, he loves that frisson with the live audience. And when something happens in the room, you know, he'll acknowledge it and embrace it. He's also, you know, like Sophia, just wildly collaborative. And so it was a very fun process. I mean, you can imagine how much laughter was in that rehearsal room.
Yeah. I was researching him a little bit too. And his Broadway credits as like a leading man are very limited. And this is a big role to hand someone with. What did you see in him that you were like, yeah, he's going to carry this show? This no brainer.
Well, I think he's very, very funny. He's very quick on his feet, and he has this kind of edge in darkness, you know. But there's a sort of empathy to everything you see. I mean, when you saw him play Dewey in School of Rock, the character's, you know, a total loser, might be hard to relate to in certain ways, but you love him and you immediately sympathize with him. And I think that's, you know, Beetlejuice, the character is a sociopath, you know, so you need that quality.
Right, right. And working with William Ivy Long too.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Costumes are incredible too. What was that process like, the collaborative process? Was it like an extension of what you were talking about with the house transforming? Because the costumes seem to be part of the living, breathing entity of the show too.
Yeah, we knew we wanted the costumes to be magical and to be cool and to have transformation. And immediately, you know, when you think of transformation on stage, you think of William Ivy Long, you think of Cinderella or the 74 other Broadway shows he's designed, literally.
Literally 75 shows, yeah.
And so the process began with him. We were supposed to do a production of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum about 4 years ago. And so I was really excited to work with him, and that didn't end up happening. And so when this opportunity came around, and David Korins had worked with him on Grease, mm-hmm. on the Grease Live show on TV, and was like, oh, you guys are going to get along. He's the perfect guy for this. And the collaboration was fantastic. And William, you know, you wouldn't know that he had designed so many Broadway shows and had so much experience, so many, you know, great achievements and awards in his past, because he treated it like it was his first show out of college. I mean, he surrounded his studio in these like stripe studies, how much black, how much white, 60% black, 40% white. What is stripes on stripes? Every kind of thing. And so I think the first 4 months was just looking at like black and white graphic prints. Wow. And then, and then it evolved. So I'd say that design process was probably about 2 years on the costumes. On the set, it was 5 years. I've never worked on a show, the design process for as long as it was on this one.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? How long does it normally take?
It depends. You know, it depends on the show, but these were very long. Yeah.
I guess it sort of has to be, though. I mean, and you've got sort of the financial backing, too, because Warner Brothers has some deep pockets, I would assume. So it's you're not constricted by time, you know, like pressure to get to the stage at all?
Well, it was interesting because Beetlejuice, because we wanted the set to be a part of the kind of, it was part of the initial idea of like, how are we going to do this?
Yeah.
We brought in Korins, the set designer, much earlier than you would on pretty much any show. So he was there for the writing process. He's maybe the third hire on the show.
Oh, no kidding.
I think he even preceded the composer, possibly. To look back at that. And so we went through a real iterative process. There were a bunch of different sets for this show, even though we said it's going to take place in a house. But, you know, we went through, even though the set has a lot of scale and there's a lot of spectacle within it, it's actually much simpler than our initial designs. And I find that sort of the budgeting process and the kind of the practicalities of that, I love that part of the process, because it really forces you in a very creative way, or in a surprisingly creative way, to just refine your ideas and hone them mm-hmm. to what are the most important ones. And for Beetlejuice, I thought it was, you know, it was really successful. So I love the collaboration with producers and general managers and production managers as you work with the design team and figuring out what are the essential things you need, you know?
Right. Yeah, that seems like you come, the show gets put into previews or out of town as like a steak with a bunch of fat on it. And then as you cook the steak, you, of course, or you go to eat the steak, you're taking all the fat off the sides, and then you present this perfectly, hopefully perfect piece sure. of meat yeah. to your audience. But I guess talking about the out of town though, you did your out of town in DC.
Uh-huh.
And what happened in the process between DC and New York, what was learned in DC that was kind of unexpected?
As we opened the show in DC, we were really proud of it and excited about it. We had a lot of audiences who really loved it and it sold really well, but not all the reviews were great. Two of the really important ones were, had a really tough time with the show. So we went back to the drawing board in a really significant way and just sort of looked at a bunch of things. We looked at the emotional on-ramps for the show. You know, how quickly are you connecting with Beetlejuice? Those sort of things, those kind of empathetic qualities mm-hmm. of Beetlejuice. Looking at creating more emotional on-ramps to Lydia, relatability in the Maitlands. Looking at the father-daughter relationship between Lydia and Charles. Looking at what happens in the netherworld and how it can work better for us. Looking at tone, there was just a lot of stuff that felt maybe a little like overstuffed, I think was a word that was used, and kind of just maybe pushed the show sometimes into edgy a place for a lot of audiences. This was the feedback we were sort of gathering. So mm-hmm. we said, okay, let's try all these things. So it was this really amazing thing happened amongst the producers, the designers, the actors, and the writers, and chiefly among the writers. And they just said, oh, okay, so we started creating lists and we were like, okay, here's 10 things we can do to address this question. Here's 12 things. We had this massive thing we marched forward with. A lot of it affected the design, you know, whether it was the end of Act One or the beginning of Act Two or the beginning of, you know, every scene had substantial changes in terms of the writing, the tone, and the design. I have to say, I've never been a part of a team effort like that. That, you know, because you're working on the show for 9 years, and then suddenly it's like change almost everything. The actors, you know, were super on board and were excited and, you know, fired up about it, and were just so wonderful. And what could be a very, you know, tricky circumstance, and so everyone just had this kind of, felt like a communal kind of effort. Everyone knew exactly what we were trying to do in terms of our stated artistic goals, and we worked hard. And even during tech, where like the cardinal rule is you don't change the show during tech, right? Because it's, especially on a show like that, that's so complicated. We tossed a song and put in a new song. We rehearsed it in the upper lobby while we were rehearsing a dance number on stage. The actors were heroic, and so were the writers. It was really amazing.
I mean, during tech for the Broadway?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is.
It's one of my favorite songs in the show, too. So it's great. Yeah.
Oh, the new one or the one that was cut?
The new one.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy. So in DC, like, was it a darker story, or I guess general tonality, was it darker in DC and more comedic here, or sort of vice versa?
Well, it was comedic in both places. I just think it was naughtier in DC. It was a little more sort of envelope pushing in the humor. Mm-hmm. I think it's still there. I don't think that's been cut out. I think it's just been the amount of it has been sort of tempered. It was sort of getting away a little bit, I think, in terms of the emotional experience. And I think for certain audience members, it's creating a kind of a wall that prevented you from entering and enjoying the show. So, it was a good evolution.
Thanks for listening to part one of this episode with Alex Timbers. Please visit us online at ttp.fm and show your support by visiting ttp.fm/Patreon. If you're a $5 supporter or more, you get advance notice of these interviews, so you can actually submit your questions to be asked as well. Stay tuned in a few days for part two.
Take a deep breath, make the world a little colorful.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.